You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. We're here with Professor Henry Blair from the New York Stern, New York University Stern School of Business. The focus today is his wonderful new book, which is called Turnaround, Third World Lessons for First World Growth. Welcome. We're looking forward to hearing all about it. We have Yuri Dadush next to him, Senior Associate and Director of the International Economics Program at Carnegie Endowment. Welcome, Yuri.
Thanks, Leslie.
And then we have Domenico Lombardi, a Senior Fellow here at Brookings on global, specialized in global economy and development, and someone both of you have known from the World Bank, where you were previously, so good. So just to set it up, the rise of emerging economies and the development in developing economies is a focus of everyone, considering what's going on, low growth, higher unemployment, and so on in the developed world. What can they learn from the policies and from the development in these emerging economies? And that's the focus of your book. So we're interested to hear what you have to say, your story. A compelling one. I was actually reading it before I was asked to moderate this panel, so it had caught my attention. And I was actually looking at some of the reviews, which call it a concise and controversial statement of what needs to be overcome if the world economy is to return to the path of growth and stability. So we're going to give you an opportunity to set it up for us, and then we'll follow with comments by Yuri and then Domenico, and then we'll go into a Q&A.
Terrific.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. And I'm hoping that your interest in the book before being asked to be on the panel is a leading indicator of its future sales. So thank you very much. The first world nations, the United States, Western Europe, Japan, the central argument in the book is the first world nations look very similar to what third world nations, quote-unquote third world nations, looked like three decades ago. High debt, slow growth, and a lack of direction. And the central argument in Turnaround is that there's much that the first world can learn from the third world in order to right our own economic ship. And in particular, the third world's struggle with economic reforms can teach us what we need to do to get back on track. So specifically, I argue that the third world's struggle with economic reforms teaches us about three things we need to see a more prosperous future. And those three things are what I call discipline, clarity, and trust. So I'm going to try to be disciplined myself. I'm going to hold to my 15-minute allotment. And so what I will do is just give you the very sort of top-line view of the main arguments. So I've already made three claims: high debt, slow growth, lack of direction. Just very, very, very briefly, what are those? So, from 2002 to 2007, we had one of the most prosperous periods in world history, the fastest five-year period of global growth ever, 4.9% per year for the global economy as a whole, with emerging markets leading the way. In 2012, very different situation, 1.3% growth in advanced nations, emerging markets at 5.3%, and in particular, if you look at Europe is contracted last year. Debt. Throughout that boom period, from 2002 to 2007, contrary to what standard economic policy teaches us, and this is the point about discipline, discipline doesn't mean what you think it means. Discipline doesn't mean austerity, nor does it mean wasteful spending. Discipline means a sustained commitment to prosperity. And in the context of fiscal policy, discipline means countercyclical fiscal policy. So from 2002 to 2007, we did see countercyclical fiscal policy in emerging countries. On average, they ran fiscal surpluses of about 1% of GDP. In contrast, advanced nations were running deficits on the order of 3% of GDP. And as a result of that, we now see average debt levels in advanced nations in excess of 100%. And in emerging nations, debt levels are substantially lower, on the order of 30% on average. So the first thing I'd like to do is to talk about what does discipline actually mean. So, as I said, discipline does not mean austerity. It doesn't mean wasteful spending. To put it in what I like to call sort of dietary terms, discipline isn't crash dieting, nor is it binge eating, or sugary sodas if you're from New York. In the book, I say discipline is a sustained commitment to long-term prosperity that is both vigilant and flexible and values what's good for the country as a whole over what's good for any individual, interest group, or person running for political office. And the history of the third world struggle with economic reform teaches us what discipline means in everything from the context of fiscal policy to international trade to international capital flows, for example. So let me give you a specific example in terms of fiscal policy. Countercyclical fiscal policy. Let's take two contrasting countries. In 2001, the United States had ran a $236 billion fiscal surplus. We made a record fiscal surplus in 2000 as well. We made a conscious decision to not be countercyclical, to be pro-cyclical, and to give back that surplus in the form of tax cuts. We know where that's gotten us today. In contrast, Chile. In 2008, Chile experienced a boom. The Treasury was taking in record amounts of revenue as a result of the commodity boom, in particular the surge in the price of copper. Andres Velasco, the finance minister, was burned in effigy in 2008 for refusing to give back the people's money, as it were. He said, no, this money's for a rainy day. The financial crisis hit. Chile was able to institute a $4 billion tax cut package to cushion the blow of the financial crisis. Countercyclical fiscal policy. Third world ants, first world grasshoppers, if you will. Okay, that's discipline. And we can talk maybe perhaps later about what discipline means in the context of trade policy, in the context of international capital flows. The second point, clarity. So third world countries were able to turn themselves around and become emerging markets when their leaders displayed a clear commitment to a change of direction. The example I'd like to use here is again a broader example from Latin America. So in 1984, a year before James A. Baker III made his very famous speech in Seoul, South Korea at the World Bank IMF meetings, where he unveiled his quote-unquote program for sustained growth, which became the basis for the Washington Consensus that was later coined by John Williamson from across the street. The year before James Baker made that famous speech, which really set off a firestorm about what discipline actually means in the context of economic policy. And I think I've laid out a definition in the book, which I think is a useful one. But in the year before Baker made that speech, if you were to look at the price-earnings ratio in Latin America, the average price-earnings ratio was 3.5. So the stock market was in the tank. And why is this relevant? Well, part of the argument, a central part of the argument in the book, is that we can actually get the best barometer we can get for whether a given policy change is likely to create or destroy value is to look at how the stock market responds to the announcement of an economic policy change or a set of economic policy changes. And so as of 1984, stock markets in the emerging world were at a price earnings ratio of 3.5 due to, among other things, great uncertainty about the future, inflation risk, expropriation risk, closed markets, and a general lack of direction about economic policy in the future. Over the course of the next decade, as you know, post Baker's speech, as Latin America began to really struggle with the issue of reform, and finally in 1994, I would argue really made a very clear shift in direction. If you look at the inflation numbers on average in Latin America as a whole, 1994 is the year in which inflation really dropped off of a cliff. In particular, I'm thinking now about the stabilization program in Brazil, the Real program, initiated by Fernando Henrique Cardoso, continued by Lula da Silva when he became president. Price earnings ratios in Latin America went from 3.5 in 1984 to 14, very close to world averages, which is what theory would predict would happen as a result of opening up to the rest of the world and implementing a whole range of policy changes. So as a result of a clear change in direction, there was a quadrupling of valuations of corporate assets in Latin America. And very importantly, as the price-earnings ratio went from 3.5 to 14, the cost of capital fell, right? The cost of capital is really just the inverse of the price-earnings ratio. And so as the cost of capital fell in Latin America, investment also surged. Projects that were negative net present value projects, because of all the issues that I mentioned before, became positive net present value projects. Investment surged, and in particular, as Latin American countries opened their capital markets to foreign investment, capital flowed into the stock market, facilitated foreign direct investment, and we also saw a substantial increase in wages and productivity. So, clarity, a clear change of direction towards lower inflation, more open markets for goods and services, more open capital markets, a smaller role for the state, and privatizing inefficiently operated state-owned enterprises really turned things around in Latin America. So let me come to the last point then, trust. Why is trust critical? Well, back up for a second. We know that that we are in a period of slow growth in advanced nations. I mentioned 1.3% last year, and we know that emerging that advanced nations will grow more slowly certainly than emerging nations for very good theoretical reasons. There's catch-up growth going on in the emerging world, so we don't expect advanced nations to grow at 5% per year. But 1.3%, as Martin Bailey can tell you, is nowhere near trend growth in the advanced nations. We think that the United States is something closer to 2.7%, 2.8%, probably 2.2% or something like that in Europe. So we're underachieving right now. And we're deleveraging. We've experienced a financial crisis, which we know from the work of people like Reinhardt and Rogoff leads to much slower recoveries typically. So the emerging nations for the first time are driving the global recovery. So we need the emerging nations to continue to grow. And we would like them to grow even more quickly by continuing down this disciplined road of a clear change in policy direction so that they can grow even faster to provide even more momentum to our economies. But the question is, will that happen? And the argument in the book is that without trust, without greater trust between emerging nations, the leadership, governments in emerging nations, and the leadership of advanced nations, we are undermining the possibility, the likelihood of emerging nations continuing down that road. So what do I mean by that specifically? Let me give some examples. So I mentioned Latin America more broadly. I mentioned Chile. Expand now to thinking about the BRICS as a whole. The BRICS account for roughly 20% of global GDP. In the international institutions that largely determine the rules of the game, what discipline means and so on, in international discussions, the IMF and the World Bank, the BRICS account for only 11.5% of the voting shares. By contrast, the nations of the Eurozone account for roughly 24% of global GDP and account for 32% of the votes. So there's a great imbalance. If you want to talk about global imbalances, there's a great imbalance between voice and say in the international institutions and contributions to the global economy that really reflect, frankly, the antiquated allotments in the immediate aftermath of World War II. And why does this matter? Well, there's reform. There's what others have called reform fatigue in the emerging world. This lack of reciprocity, this lack of a willingness to give emerging nations their proportionate say in conversations about the global economy undermines their leaders' ability, frankly, to sell to their electorates further reforms. Let me give you another example. During the height of the crisis, advanced nations came out and stated very strongly, we are all committed to free trade. We have to continue to have open markets in order to ensure the stability of the world economy. And what did we get between November 2008 and November 2010? According to the World Trade Report, there were more than 800 instances of protectionist measures instigated. More than 40% of those came from G8 countries. So there are many other examples in the book of essentially do as I say, not as I do, and I think there's a great risk that what I call, frankly, the trust deficit which I think is in many ways at least as important as the discussion about fiscal deficits right now, undermines the ability of emerging nations leaders to continue to push for the kinds of reforms that that need to happen in order for them to grow even faster and to help help us in this recovery. So I think I've reached the end of my time, according to my watch here. So let me just close by saying that it's really quite striking to me that we now have a third world pope. And so if arguably the most conservative institution in the world, the Catholic Church, can find the humility to acknowledge the growing importance of its base, so to speak, then can't the most important economic institutions in the world do something similar to ensure that we have the trust we need between between countries to drive future prosperity? So let me stop there.
Thank you, Professor.
It is a fascinating thought to think that the world, you know, looking back to the 70s, 80s, and 90s, that, you know, that everybody was talking down to these countries, and now, you know, we're electing them as popes. So, Yuri, let's hear what you have to say. You know, the third world was forced to live within its means. Should the developed world do that too?
Yes, is the answer. Thank you very much. And the fact that we have a third world pope means that you have to have faith. You have to have faith. So I very much enjoyed Peter's book, Turnaround. It's a great read. It's very well written. And it simultaneously takes a different and refreshing look at some important aspects of development thinking, and also challenges advanced countries to do better by learning from developing countries, which, of course, is another novel endeavor. Now, it is possible to quibble with details. Unfortunately, I do that a lot. There is a typo in the second sentence of your introduction, which says that Mexico has 1.9 million manufacturing workers. Well, Mexico's got to have a lot more than 1.9 million manufacturing workers, maybe 10 times as much. So I just want to alert you to that.
The data still has to catch up.
There's also a statement that low-income countries do not attract a lot of FDI, and the FDI they attract is just in mining. In fact, in recent years, they've attracted a lot of FDI in services. There's also a statement that developing countries and advanced country stock markets are uncorrelated. In fact, they are highly correlated and increasingly so. But it is also possible to disagree with some broad claims made in the book. For example, that the advanced countries were the real obstacle to a Doha deal. I, as director of trade at the World Bank, followed the negotiations over 10 years, and I assure you that there is plenty of blame to go around on the Doha debacle. Even though Peter is careful in the way that he makes the case, I still think that he places too much stock in the stock market. I'm sure this is not the first time you hear that. The stock market is a source of confirmation that policies work. After all, the long history of financial bubbles is a history of stock markets getting it wrong. And stock markets are enormously volatile, while policy is a long-term endeavor. So, you know, I find the information useful, interesting, but I think it has to be treated with great care, the relationship to the stock market. But for the most part, I found myself agreeing with Peter's analysis and his conclusions. I found his comparison of the performance of Jamaica and Barbados to be especially interesting, a very useful health warning against the predeterminism of Asimoglu and Robinson. And I hope at some point you'll tell us if they ever reacted to that, because it is a striking example of two countries with very similar colonial, et cetera, history, and that have strikingly different outcomes. The comparison you make between the Brady Plan and HIPC debt relief is also, I thought, very useful. Whether or not one agrees with the conclusion that the former worked very well, but the latter did not, that the HIPC did not, I think your analysis is a very good example of the need to think about the broader context whenever one is evaluating a specific policy, especially an important policy measures. You have to look at the broader context. Of course, Peter Henry's message that the advanced countries are not giving the developing countries enough respect now that the latter are the drivers of world growth resonated strongly with me. And I know it's going to resonate even more strongly with Domenico and with many here. However, I was less convinced by Peter's attempt to draw lessons for the advanced countries from the developing countries, which, after all, is the subtitle of the book. I was left to ask, well, what exactly do you mean when you speak about discipline? What is discipline? And maybe I'm too much of an economist, and I forgot the basics. But and if you even if you define discipline in a way that I can grasp, is it in fact true that policymaking in Germany or the United Kingdom is less disciplined? These are two relatively slow-growing advanced countries. Is less disciplined than it is in India or Brazil or Nigeria, which are relatively fast-growing countries. Also, I felt there was a lack of distinguo in the book. I mean, there are some advanced countries that have actually done very well in recent years. Canada, Australia, Sweden, Israel are some of the ones that, not all of them are commodity exporters. Some of those that spring to mind, but and there are also many developing countries that have done terribly. I don't even mention the U.S. because I'm not sure there is any economic policy making in the U.S. Today outside the Federal Reserve. So there I agree with you, and I know you have the U.S. in mind. But exhortation that the advanced countries need to get their act together, of which the book is full, they need to stabilize their macro picture, they need to liberalize and increase competition, do structural reforms, etc., etc., that's all to the good, but it only takes you far enough, it only takes you so far. And so I was left to ask, what are the deeper causes of the acceleration of developing countries and the sharp deceleration of advanced countries as a group over the last 20 years or so. We probably have a better explanation now from the Growth Commission, a lot of the work that has been done in many places about the acceleration of the developing countries and why it happened and why it should have happened earlier, but it happened now, et cetera, et cetera. I think we have a pretty good picture. I think there's a lot of questions of why Japan struggles, why Italy struggles, why et cetera. And, you know, I call it the rich country trap. Is there a rich country trap? What is the nature of the trap? And we know that financial crises are part of the reason, of course. And we know that the sovereign debt crisis in Europe, the euro is an enormous own goal, to use a soccer analogy, that really didn't have to happen. We know that that's part of the reason. But there are also deeper questions. One of them is technology, in fact. Are we running out of technology? This is one of the discussions that's going on at the moment. There are also very deep questions about the income distribution trends and the social cohesion in developing in advanced countries, the workings of the welfare state, the ability of the welfare state to deal with globalization, et cetera, the dysfunctionality of the health system, et cetera. And why is it that these ills affect advanced countries disproportionately? There have been some efforts to look into this. I'm thinking of Raghu Rajan's book on the United States, but really not enough. And so I think this is a great book, but you need to write another book. Your next book should address these questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Yuri. Domenico, as the Italian on the panel, can a third world pope change the lives of many? Maybe we could put this into economics.
Well, thank you, Leslie, and I really enjoyed reading your book, Henry, and I did found a lot of material, a lot of food for thoughts, especially given that here at Brookings, in the program I am affiliated to, we have been working a lot on the Eurozone crisis. And therefore, if you will allow me, I'll try to sort of condense what the main lessons from your book are for someone like me who comes from Europe, who has been focusing a lot on the IMF, but also on the Eurozone crisis. And really, I found five lessons, in reading your book. So essentially, in order to run a successful economic reform program, a growth-enhancing reform program, you need five requirements, sort of. Discipline, pragmatism, ownership, humility, and leadership. So let me go, one by one and see how I would try to characterize, and if I have understood your book correctly, what are the features underpinning each requirement. And also, let me add a little bit, from my own perspective. Clearly, discipline is a term that frequently recurs in your book. And I have to say that, these times, yesterday I was just flying from Madrid. This is also a word that is heavily recurrent in Europe nowadays. Unfortunately, for the wrong reasons, though. In fact, you pointed out that discipline is essentially a sustained commitment to a long-term program of, to a long-term prosperity type of objective. So essentially, discipline is a means, is not an objective in itself. Discipline cannot be a policy, but it's something that, of course, is going to enhance the effectiveness of your policy. And I think, with this in mind, I think we have to recognize that, discipline might be a good thing if it is applied, in an appropriate way. Otherwise, the risk is that you are going to hit the wall. And this brings me to the second lesson that comes out from your book. That's pragmatism. And I'm glad that you are sort of coming up with this by looking at the lessons of successful developing economies. Because clearly, if I say that from Italy, I wouldn't have the same credibility. And at the core of economic reform, you say, at its core, economic reform is not about ideology, but is a practical matter of triggering and sustaining catch-up, or I would add, economic growth more in general. So I very much enjoyed the part of your book where you talk about the approach by former Chinese leader Deng. They invite the World Bank mission. They say, look, we have an objective, long-term prosperity. We can do it without you. However, if we do it with you, it's going to be quicker and faster. And look, now it may seem pretty normal, that a Chinese leader might have said that, but I think that back in the 80s, it must have taken quite an effort, including vis-à-vis his own party colleagues, and so on. And let me try to find, you know, a couple of analogs, unfortunately, that are not so successful. China, of course, has been very successful in that, in adopting a very pragmatic approach. Europe is not. I was mentioning yesterday, coming back from Madrid, where we had a very interesting workshop with ESADE. There were senior political figures in this workshop, and some of us, you know, actually writing on the Eurozone crisis. And, you know, I was a little bit surprised by the comments of a German colleague of mine. He was saying, look, you, meaning southern European economies, you have to engineer some export-led growth. I mean, essentially, this is a replication of the German model. As you know, Germany's current account now is higher than China's, both in respect to GDP as well as in absolute terms. Now, my question to him, my rebuff to him was, look, this is okay if you are a smaller economy of the Eurozone. Clearly, you can do whatever you want at the margin. But if you get relatively larger economies like Italy, Spain, and the rest of Southern Europe engineering a so-called export boom, to whom are you going to sell your net exports? Because clearly China has a surplus. The U.S., I heard not long ago, that wants to be a little bit more like China. The Gulf, of course, runs a surplus. Clearly, there has to be some symmetric adjustment within the Eurozone. And therefore, this really calls for some economic cooperation within the Eurozone, bearing in mind, of course, that the southern economies have to do their own adjustments. So this is not to discount that in any sense. Then there is another case that I also found interesting, still on this issue of pragmatism, the cold turkey approach, really slashing fiscal deficit. You mentioned some cases of countries with hyperinflation. We have to think carefully, when we apply the therapy, what is the disease? And there's always a risk of doing a misdiagnosis. So, of course, whenever you have an hyperinflation economy, you might want to adopt a cold turkey approach to shock expectations. But if we look at the Eurozone and the southern economies of the Eurozone, in the case of my own country, Italy, the problem is not the fiscal deficit. And I have the data with me just to be precise. Italy has been running over the last decade a deficit to GDP ratio of about 3%. I'm not saying that it was tight, but it was not overspending either. If we look at the debt to GDP ratio, the debt to GDP ratio was 108% when Italy joined the Eurozone, and it bottomed to 103.4% in the middle of last decade. And you know, this year, how much it's going to shoot? 130%. So since 2009, where Italy experienced a contraction of 5.5%, in this country where the crisis originated, contraction was 3.2% that year. In Italy, it was 5.5%. And since that moment onwards, the debt-to-GDP ratio has been escalating. And the irony is that this year, there will be a balanced budget in Italy, and yet the debt-to-GDP ratio is going to hit this unprecedented threshold of 130%. This is just to say that what looks like as a fiscal problem, this escalating debt-to-GDP ratio, has little to do or less to do with the fiscal deficits, but actually has a lot to do with lack of growth. And this is really the problem. So if you don't tackle that issue, that problem, you're going to have, this is going to feed into a fiscally unsustainable dynamics with all the problems that we know of. So this is really the issue. And what is the answer? The fiscal compact. So you have to run a balanced budget. So this year they're going to run a balanced budget, but they're going to experience another contraction and so on. So being flexible, you know, if you are a sailor and the wind shifts, you can change your tack. That's not going to mean that you are going to dock your boat in a different harbor at the end of the day. So that's really, you know, the main lesson. The third lesson is ownership. And, you know, clearly for those of us who are IMF scholars, who have been researching a lot on the IMF, ownership is very important, and it really comes out in your book very well. You mentioned the fact that Chile had three IMF stabilization programs. No one of them really managed to bring their moderate inflation down. But in the end, you know, the Central Bank of Chile in the 90s managed where, you know, teaming up with other international organizations wasn't really successful. And this is to say that clearly nothing can really substitute for ownership. There is no troika. There is nothing that can replace what ownership can lead you to, and this is of course important. What we see now, and you know, again, we had general elections in Italy. It was actually people overwhelmingly rejected these austerity-led policies imposed by Europe. They did not reject the euro or the idea of Europe, but they did reject overwhelmingly the sort of economic receipt that was imposed on them. And then humility. And I think this is really, you know, one of the lessons that I found most interesting, and to be honest, it really forced me to think in those terms. I was not really, you know, ownership I'm familiar with. But you may not get it right the first time. So, again, you mentioned, you know, that in cases of disinflation from hyperinflation, you may be more successful, you are more likely to be successful, but still you have to try a number of times. Again, when you disinflate from moderate inflation, your rate of success is even lower. You have to accept failure, basically. It's a trial whatever. Yeah, I forgot the expression, but basically. This is also, you know, something that, you know, comes very strongly from your book. And again, the same success stories in your book are of those economies who were applying the dependency theory, the import substitution theory early on. And then, you know, they sort of realized the limits and the failures of those approaches. And they were sort of smart enough to, and were open to new approaches. And therefore, you know, again, if I have to translate this in terms of you know, the European crisis, they haven't got it right this time, but it doesn't mean that, you know, Europe or the euro is going to disintegrate necessarily, clearly, you know, there might be a feedback and there might be a revaluation, a reassessment of their policy failures. So in a way, this is a reason of optimism, even if the data, you know, looks pretty, pretty bad. And then the last lesson is, I would say, leadership. And leadership is not just national leadership. Clearly, you need to have an enlightened leadership in China or in Chile for doing what they have done. But it is also a unique combination of national and international leadership. Where would those economies be without the great leadership of, you know, the former U.S. Treasury Secretaries, Brady and James Baker before Brady? You know, at the time China was trying to open up, the U.S. Granted a special status to China. Supported China's joining of the WTO. So, again, you need to... these economies do not prosper in a vacuum. So you need a combination of national and international leadership. If I have to translate this into the European, crisis, maybe there might be some national leadership here and there, but I do not see any regional leadership. And in fact, the only name that comes up when we talk about Europe or the euro is Mario Draghi, but he's not a politician, at least, you know, yet, so far. So, then if I have just one more minute or...
One more minute.
you know, that said, you know, I don't think if I say that I agree with you, it's very sort of, you know, it does well to the panel. So, you know, on IMF, on IMF reform, we all, I mean, clearly I agree with you, and, you know, Leslie knows that, and I have some public position. But what I, you know, especially having read your book, what I don't really understand is, you know, a couple of years ago when they, the IMF membership had to elect the fifth French managing director out of 11. There have been 11. They are all from Western Europe, and about five of them are French. So how is that a powerful economy like China, which is today the second largest economy, according to Goldman Sachs, it could be the first in a few decades. How is it, you know, China, India, China is never going to borrow from the IMF just because the IMF has not the financial capacity to lend to China. How is it China or other, you know, very large economies in the end decided to support a European candidate? So that I found, you know, a little bit sort of difficult to understand. And I mean, clearly there are reasons, but they are not so compelling after all. It's not that if they had voted for someone else, the European Union would have heightened, you know, trade barriers or anything like that. One very final point. It's not in your book, but actually, you know, it does strengthen the scope and the meaning and the sense of your book. You don't refer to the experience of a very successful, relatively small but very successful regional organization made up of developing countries. That's FLAR, the Latin American Reserve Fund. Was established a few decades ago among Andean countries, and it has been providing loans to their to its members without conditionality. No one has ever defaulted. At times, members were in arrears with the IMF. I'm referring to Peru in the 80s, but Peru was fulfilling all its obligations vis-à-vis FLAR. And likewise, you know, if you take the sister organization, CAF, again, a very successful experience, their ratings are higher than the ratings of their own member countries. I think this is all, you're an expert on, so you may want to look into that. And I think really, you know, the sense of ownership, of peer, you know, pressure in a good sense is very strong. And this is something that, again, is not very well known, but I think, you know, deserves to be much better known. With that, I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Domenico. Interesting, interesting thoughts from both of you. Let me get energy on the thing. Good. Well, let's start this off with looking at the crisis in the United States. We live it every day. We see it on TV. We live in Washington. We know it's. Sometimes we don't know what's going on. But when you look at the, is not the issue. The issue here is trying to lift growth and not to unsettle that very fragile recovery that we're on now. The question is it cutting? Should one cut taxes? Raise taxes? What or austerity? What are you from your research in the developing world learnt or have a lesson for the U.S. as it goes through this?
So I think I'd like to focus on the issue of clarity, and others may have other things that they want to add. But just to point out that if you think about kind of a macro view, what's going on in the United States right now? On the one and the world more broadly, actually, just to expand the discussion, you have extremely expansionary monetary policy, you know, outright monetary transactions in Europe, quantitative easing here, and you've contractionary fiscal policy.
So just from kind of a textbook point of view, you have monetary policy and fiscal policy working at cross purposes. That's a lack of clarity about what we're trying to do. And so I think the discussion about fiscal policy really needs to be, first of all, seen in that context, and then ask the question, how do we think about a holistic approach? Right. So rather than sort of immediately focusing on, you know, what's untouchable, what's touchable, let's agree that we want a pro-growth, holistic approach that's, you know, progressive, and gives certainty about where we're headed. So I think if we could start at those principles, and then get to specific, as Domenico used, sort of tactics, which way we're going to attack, I think that the discussion would be a lot more productive. Right now, we've gotten mired in this false trade-off between austerity and stimulus, which just isn't very helpful.
But isn't there, when you, Domenico, you look at Europe, you know, the Germans feel that they, you know, you need to stick to the goals. The IMF is actually backing a lot of the other countries and saying, you can ease a bit on that. Let's push up growth. That should be the focus. What is the solution here?
You know, again, from you know, my sort of European angle, I think there is you know, really too much emphasis on the deficit and you know how much deficit we're gonna have this year, next year. But actually, again, if you look at Spanish data, if you look at Italian data, what you do see is that there is really a problem of composition of expenditures and relative efficiency. And I think this is really the issue. So, you know, and this is what the regional community, the international community should make pressure on those countries on, you know, in terms of making their expenditures and the relative composition of expenditures more efficient. Rather than just cutting here or there. And I think there is too much emphasis, you know, on the latter aspect rather than on the former.
Yuri, what is your feeling about what you're watching on television every night going on in Congress? You know, is there an easy way for the United States to deal with what's going on?
Well, I think a lot of countries... as Larry Summers likes to say repeatedly, would like to have the problem of the United States. I mean, I think the United States is supremely well-positioned to deal with its own problems in so many respects. But the problem of the United States isn't that. The problem of the United States is its political cohesion. And I agree with Domenico that far too much emphasis is being placed on the deficit this year or next. And it's really consistent with my view that the United States is a very strong economy that can deal with its issues. It's a question of timing. So there is a, frankly for me, not especially interesting short-term kind of demand management issue, you know, the mix between monetary and fiscal policy and the speed, et cetera, of adjustment. Most people would agree that, you know, the adjustment in this situation needs to be gradual. Yeah, we have a high unemployment. We don't have inflation, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the least interesting question. To me, the more interesting questions in the U.S., very briefly, are, number one, the long-term trends on healthcare, the issue of efficiency. The healthcare is the disaster of the United States economy. It is 18% of GDP, and it's not delivering results. White males that didn't finish high school are seeing a decline in their life expectancy in the United States. 4 years over the last 20, the life expectancy has gone down. This is the richest country in the world, and it's spending 18% on healthcare. There are very, very fundamental issues. That's the most fundamental issue, which is actually affecting everything else. The second is the savings rate. I know I was just listening to Martin before, but I would have said it anyway, Martin. the savings rate, a very big issue with the incentives to spend in this country, in the private sector, in particular the household sector. And the third issue is inequality. The inequality trends in the United States stand out. They're very striking. The middle class, in a country that has been growing faster than the average of the advanced countries, has seen a decline in its real per capita incomes over the last 13, 14 years. And I know that there are people at Brookings who will do, you know, some adjustments, et cetera, that will show that that's not quite true. But fundamentally, this is the broad trend. And this goes back to the initial point that the United States doesn't have so much of an economic underlying fundamental problem. It has a cohesion problem. It has a political problem.
Professor Erie, what did you see or what have you learned from prioritizing? I mean, if anything, in the developing world, they've had to prioritize. They've had few resources, and they've had to figure out what is important to them now, and then what's important over the long term. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think priorities is a very important word. I think priorities is a nice way of tying together what you and Domenico are saying. So in a broad sense, there's far too much focus on austerity, not a focus on reform, structural reforms. The key thing is, what are the changes that will deliver the most bang for the buck in any given country? And as Erie said, the issues in the United States are very different than they are, for example, in Italy. And what I think that the developing countries have been most successful at turning around their economies are those who have figured out, okay, what's the most kind of important kind of rate-limiting step, if you will, that we can address in our economy. And I think a nice example that I'd like to point to is the example of South Korea. So everyone talks about South Korea's export-led growth strategy. And as Domenico was saying, you know, the whole world can't have an export-led growth strategy. But I'd just like to sort of make a little addendum to that. It's true we can't all run net trade surpluses. We know that. But if you look at the world as a whole, it's never run a net trade surplus, but the overall volume of world trade has increased dramatically over the last 40 years, and that has had a huge impact on growth. Why? Because the fundamental issue in trade is not whether you have a trade surplus, but whether you use your resources efficiently. And so South Korea, during its period of most rapid growth from 1965 to 1990, ran serial trade deficits. People don't realize that. It learned to export by importing. So, but it made priorities in terms of in thinking, okay, we can use the world market as a way to achieve economies of scale domestically, and for instance, you know, produce color televisions for the rest of the world, even if we don't have color television broadcasting locally. So prioritization is key, and we have to figure out what are the key priorities in the United States. And I think inequality is a big issue, and I think one of the key issues which drives inequality, frankly, is our lack of an adequate educational system. The scholars at Brookings and almost any other first-rate academic institution will tell you there's an inexorable increase in the returns to being skilled, and that drives the wage gap. So unemployment is 7.7%, but if you have an MBA or some other form of education, the unemployment rate is 3.8% in that group. And the returns to education in that group are quite high. So the question is, the males who aren't graduated from high school, how do we prepare them for the 21st century? Because as we create more skilled workers, their skill premium will drop, and the number of high-skilled, highly compensated people will rise, and that will help us address some of these issues.
Erie, as a trade expert, the China's been told now the export-led model is not a good one. We got Jack Lew going off to China soon to talk about the next part of the relationship between China and the U.S. I mean, is there anything that the U.S. could learn about exporting or generating that growth that is needed from China's experience?
This is such a different situation. And I always struggle with export-led growth. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about export-led growth. And the fundamental misunderstanding is that people think in demand terms when they're thinking about long-term growth. Mm-hmm. So if you think in demand terms, then it must be good to grow your exports. That is the fundamental. But in fact, in the case of China, this effect had virtually no effect on Chinese growth, meaning that if you look at the change in the trade balance of China, exports minus imports, the contribution of the change in the current account surplus of China to Chinese growth over a 10-20-year period is essentially zero. It's 0.1% or something like that. It's a trivial part of the growth. The fundamental importance of trade is as much import-led growth as it is export-led growth, by which I mean the effect of trade on the economy is to reposition the economy and make it more efficient and make it more productive in all sorts of ways, increasing competition, driving innovation, et cetera, et cetera. That is the heart of the importance of trade. And yes, so the United States can learn from China, but it cannot learn from China about export-led growth. It can learn from China what happens when you allow an economy to restructure at the appropriate speed and you allow it to learn from overseas, et cetera. Now, the United States is so far ahead of China. You know, United States income is five times what it is in China. So we have to be careful about learning lessons from China. But so the United States faces very, very different, challenges. I go back to my point that I made before. The most important competitive threat facing the United States is not to be found in manufacturing, is not to be found in export services. It is to be found in its healthcare system that is dysfunctional, absorbing a huge amount of resources, making Americans poor, and making Americans uncompetitive on international markets.
Domenico, I've just come back from the G20. A lot of this fight for growth in the developed world is causing, you know, a lot of competition. I mean, the so-called currency wars, people rather like to call it currency worries right now. A perception that there, some countries are forcing a devaluation in their currency to look more competitive. I was very interested at the G20 that I didn't hear from the emerging economies a lot more anger over this. It seemed that the U.S. and the G7 dealt with it through the statement, a week ahead of the G20. What is this adjustment that's going on between, you know, the rise of the emerging? It's a power adjustment. What is that telling you about, you know, increased competitiveness, and how that's going to play into future cooperation between these economies?
Yeah, what we have seen is that the G20 has, of course, been very successful at managing the crisis when the world economy was on the brink of a meltdown, and has been much less successful after then. And you know, there are of course various reasons. Certainly, there is some more incentive to cooperate when you are very close to the brink, and much less so when in the end, you have to reallocate, a much smaller pie. But the reason why I think we're going to see a little bit, more and more tensions, even in the context of the G20 between developed economies on the one hand and developing or emerging economies on the other, is that the main, some of the main advanced economies, namely the Eurozone and the United States, currently are facing mainly domestic-led challenges that relate to the nature of their own policy-making process. So just to be clear on it. So we were just talking before, in the U.S., the main challenge is essentially how the presidency, how the Congress can affect the priorities of the budget. And clearly, you know, this balance, this this battle of power, this fight in terms of who's gonna give more weight in terms of picking up the priorities for the budget, is not something that lends itself to international cooperation. Virtually, the G20 cannot do anything on that. If you look at the Eurozone, there is a power, a fight going on between the national layers of the policy-making process or agencies with the regional layers. And again, it's really a shift, you know, how much power should national authorities or some national authorities have vis-a-vis others. So again, it's another fight in terms of shaping the future nature of the policy-making process at the European level. So again, this lends itself very badly to some sort of, you know, peer review discussion in the context of the G20. And actually really, you know, pushes these countries away from the G20. And, of course, you know, what is the alternative? The alternative is essentially to resort to some, you know, unilateral actions. And of course, everybody, you know, everyone will try to do as it best can. But I think really it's not easy to figure out how this tension, how this gap in that we see in the G20 can really be overcome, because the challenges that the U.S. and the Eurozone are facing are really challenges at the heart of their own national sovereignty.
Professor, I wanted to ask you, you know, in the developing world, you know, they were all under IMF programs and had... and we're being, you know, told by the Western world what, you know, what to do. Who tells the United States and Europe what to do? I mean, how do are they going to be willing listeners, you know, of your message, basically?
Yeah. Well, you said we have to have faith. So I'm hopeful that given the current circumstances we're in, there's no misconception about the fact that we're underperforming relative to potential. And I think the really important thing here is that a lot of the responsibility falls on leaders, but I also think there's an important responsibility of the electorate to hold our leaders to a higher standard. If we have low expectations, then we shouldn't be surprised at the low quality of the debate. So so I'm hopeful. I think that there's some really extraordinary things the United States does particularly well. I'm a little biased, but I think higher education is one of the extraordinary things that we do quite well, and we know that because we see the flows that come into this country. And the question is, how do we use the information we have to hold our leaders to a higher standard on things like delivering better outcomes on everything from healthcare to fiscal policy.
One thing that when I read your book, I thought to myself, well, you know, as a South African, I've lived, you know, all over Africa and Eastern Europe, I can't help but think that the political structures in these developing countries seem so much easier to deal with. You know, when is there all that much debate going on? I mean, I know now if you look at Egypt, for example, is a lot of debate going on.
Yes, yeah. I was going to say.
But it seems to me that it was so much easier for governments to put in place these policies. I mean, there was rioting in the streets and so on, but there was a, you know, they didn't have to deal with a Congress and in all these places. Have I got...
Well, I mean, checks and balances have pluses and minuses.
Yeah.
It's certainly, I mean, take a country like Jamaica is a good example, right? So you had a parliamentary system, so you have a leader in power who can more or less for a period of time get changes through fairly easily. But Jamaica in the 1970s, that freedom was used very irresponsibly, and drove Jamaica into recession for essentially a decade and a half. So I think, you know, there's probably a minor adjustment of Churchill's quote about democracy that applies here. So I think the main lesson is, whether you're in a parliamentary democracy or a system of checks and balances like the United States, I think we can look at large democracies around the world that have made changes, whether it be, you know, I mean, I think, look at Brazil. I think as late as 1992, I think people were not very hopeful about Brazil, but somehow they found, as Domenico pointed out earlier, the leadership to actually make some tough choices and move forward. So I'm not willing to accept that our system of checks and balances, which has served our country really well for over 200 years, is the root cause of our inability to move forward.
Yuri, you have a thought?
Yeah, Leslie, on this.
And then I'm going to turn it over to
you. Yeah, on this. You may actually have it exactly wrong, Leslie.
I'm glad you said it to Leslie, not to me.
Yeah. You may actually have it exactly wrong. Sometimes I think that the reforms, the wave of reforms that we have seen in developing countries in the last 20, 30 years have something to do with the fact that as people become more aware of what's going on, they become more connected to the world, their incomes begin to rise, etc., they ask for more. They ask for more. And the leaders, then actually find it impossible not to take some of these steps that need to be taken. So I believe that the rise of the middle class in the developing countries is a very important driver of these reforms, of these demands. And in the end, people vote with their feet. All the high-income countries of the world, virtually without exception, I used to be able to say Singapore was an exception, virtually without exception, are democracies. So people converge towards that, and it's kind of part and parcel. You know, it's my theory. I haven't demonstrated it or, you know, econometrically, but it's my thesis that these things happen together. There is a rise in income, there is the democratization, there are pressures, and there is more democratization. Unfortunately, at the end, you end up with a lot of democracy and still, in many cases, very large economic problems, you know, of the ones we have been discussing in the advanced countries. And that makes it more complicated. But here's the good news. At least you're doing this from a level of per capita income of $50,000 a year instead of $5,000 a year.
Right. I'm going to open it to the audience. Is there a microphone?
Yeah, I
turn. Go. Well, head on. Hang on, your microphone's coming.
Okay. I thought I should shout. I am a novice. I don't know what economics means. Forget about even spelling it, and I'm not interested in learning it either. But it has been a very educative experience for me to listen to this conversation. But I still have a uneasiness with the whole premise on which you have just talked about this idea of what advanced countries can learn from the developing countries. Based on the three principles you mentioned. First of all, I think much of the advances, I only read newspaper, I don't read scholarly books, maybe I will now, but I haven't read. So my impression is it is not certain that this economic growth, which has taken place in various countries we have been thinking about or talking about, is persistent. It seems to me it is a leadership-dependent phenomenon, although you just mentioned it is the people who demand. Well, good luck for you. So I'm always concerned that maybe this is not going to be a long-lost phenomenon. So you made three points. You made the points of discipline, right? You made the point of clarity, and you made the point of trust. I'm not sure there is any historical or cultural tradition in many of the countries we have just talked about for any one of these elements. I think, it's, you know, you talk to people, and I haven't lived in third country, so I don't know very much personally. But reading, I don't think they have this idea of discipline, that, okay, we make a decision, we stick with it. I'm assuming your hypothesis involves that if things don't work out, we can change. It is not a monotonic decision.
What is your question?
So I want to ask you, I don't want you to make complicated arguments for all three elements, but are you convinced in your mind that these three elements can be the basis for us to learn something from the developing country applicable to us here?
Professor, is this sustainable, what's going on in this?
I'm convinced if you go back and look at the last 3.5 decades, the common threads that tie together all these experiences of successful turnaround, because, and by definition, they were sustained, right? That's what turnaround means. The common three threads are discipline, clarity, and trust.
So do you think it is sustainable that these economies continue to grow at this rate? I mean, we're talking about this. There's already some kind of, it looks like some slowdown going on. Well, there is a slowdown in China. How sustainable is this, Domenico? I mean, can they continue to grow at these rates, which is needed to lift, you know, millions out of poverty?
Well, they, I mean, clearly that's a very tough question. I mean, certainly, especially economies like China, India, they have a huge potential for doing so for the years to come. But clearly, again, as we were talking before, I think they will have to change tack. They will have to shift gear. It doesn't mean that, they're going to shift their end objective, but they will have their policy framework will have to adapt. Okay. And, if you look at right now, China is suffering a lot from the slowdown in Europe, or even the contraction we're witnessing in Europe, their own export largest market, and clearly the uncertainty that the U.S. is going through. So if anything, this is going to push more and more the Chinese authorities, I believe, towards relying more and more on domestic sources for their own growth. So again, it will depend very much to the extent they will be able to adapt, as they have been doing pretty well so far.
Do we have a question here?
I love the three dynamics of stability, discipline, clarity, and trust. They match most of the criteria my father used at The Economist for 40 years. The two other ones he would maybe add would be always be pro-youth. For example, if you bail out old people's debts by putting young people out of jobs, that's not pro-youth. And the fifth one would be, you know, map back the future from big win-wins, because financial transactions are often very zero-sum. If you can't use the extraordinary time we are in at the moment to unite the world around some bigger win-win goals. So my question to you would be, please don't write another book. Could you develop a MOOC so that millions of young people could share your constructs and at least build with them? Because that, everyone needs to debate your ideas, I think.
It actually raises a question that, about the youth. I mean, all these young unemployed people in many of these developing countries. What's going to happen?
Yeah, it's a great question and a great point. So, let's leave the MOOC aside. But let me sort of generalize. I mean, I think your general point is this point about how do we raise expectations, and I think raising expectations of youth is critical.
And involve young people in your debate.
Yes,
your
absolutely. And I think one of the ways in which we can hold our leaders accountable, frankly, is to get young people to care more about these issues. So I'll tell you about one movement which is currently going on that which I wasn't aware of until just a week and a half ago. There's a movement called Up to Us in the United States, which is a movement of across five different universities. NYU is a part of it. And they're a group of 18 to 22-year-olds, undergraduates, are educating other undergraduates and young people about, frankly, the issues you just mentioned, the ways in which we're mortgaging the future of the youth on policies today, and raising awareness to get people to get out and vote and make noise about these issues. And this is particularly important in the context of developing countries. We were talking earlier about the importance of youth unemployment, particularly male youth unemployment, is one of the most dangerous things you could have to jeopardize a country's future, because it feeds into crime, low expectations, and other things. And so I think your point is well taken. One of the reasons for writing the book, frankly, and what I hope to do, is to raise awareness of these issues precisely amongst the younger generation.
Another question? I'll get back to you in the back.
Hi, and if I can raise two related questions.
Can you identify
one,
yourself, please?
I'm Joe Guggenheim, just an interested person, retired. Two related questions. One is, do we really have to worry in this country about whether the national debt is 60% versus 80% of the GDP, given the fact that we have low inflation and then the experience of other countries around the world? And my second question is, how does China do it? they seem to be investing an awful lot, and their whole history has been, and their growth has been stimulated by direct investment, it seems to me, in infrastructure and commercial manufacturing and residential development. How do they finance that? Do they worry about budget deficits? Or do they have corporations, state-owned corporations, that can finance without having to worry about what the debt is on the national, within the government structure?
Professor, and I'm back to you. You know, the reinvestment in infrastructure allowed China in many ways to deal with its constraints.
Well, I think Yuri made the point very well. I mean, there are a lot of countries that would love to have the United States problems. If you look at the interest rate, the long-term interest rates for 10-year bonds, about 2%. Even at 100%, even at debt at 100% of GDP, that's really not a terribly onerous borrowing cost. So the question then really comes back to the issues that I think that Yuri and Domenica raised. How do we use our spending more efficiently?
Domenico or Yuri, I don't know who wants to take this question, but do you? I mean, when you look at the developing world, a lot of them were forced to live within their means because they couldn't then get the capital, to develop. They were held accountable, and I think the stock market thing comes in. Although I look at the stock market these days, and I wonder what they're reading. Record highs for stock markets. Meanwhile, there's a whole debate on sequester. So, Domenico, how does China do it? Does this matter?
Well, I think as China develops further, they will have to tackle the issue of having financial markets more efficient, with a better rule of law. With a better supervisory framework. And, in the end, there is a lot of talk about the internationalization of the renminbi. If this is ever going to happen, I mean, not that the renminbi can replace the dollar at any time, at least in my life, but if this is ever going to happen, of course, China will have to work, on this more sort of governance-related aspects, because otherwise it's going to be really unable to sustain, capital flows and really become a premier economy in the world, also from a financial standpoint. Picking up on one of the previous questions, you were asking about should the U.S. care about the debt, about whether it's 80%, 90%. Clearly the U.S. is a very peculiar case because the U.S. issues the reserve currency. So it's true that in the U.S. this concern is, less overwhelming, but this cannot be readily generalized to the other, advanced economies or even developing economies. If we look at the euro area, for instance, it's a little bit like, for those countries, it's a little bit like issuing debt in a foreign currency because they don't have their own central bank. Not completely like that, but very close to that. And clearly, this is why, debt ratios that once we thought were sustainable do not look like sustainable anymore just because these countries face potential refinancing problems because of the lack of their own central bank.
I want to get to the gentleman at the back.
Hi, Dick America, Georgetown University, School of Business. Hi, Peter.
How are you?
The quality of management in the developing world, some of us, myself included, believe that's a key constraint on progress. Would NYU put a branch in Sudan or Central African Republic? I'm being facetious about those places, but in Africa, upgrading the quality of management is crucial. I've been to Gibbs and Wits many times in Johannesburg. What is your view on how to accelerate the improvement in management quality in Africa and elsewhere?
That's a great question. And so, again, I think to your point, Dick, the American higher educational system is one of the things that we do best. And our view is we want to continue to attract students from around the world. I mean, the bad news is, as you say, there's a long way to go. But I think the good news is that the marginal product of even just a few newly trained leaders in Africa can be extraordinarily high because the stock is so low. So it's a priority for us to continue to attract the best students from wherever they are, particularly in the emerging world. irrespective of their need to pay. And we think we can make an enormous contribution over time if we stay focused on that.
We have another 10 minutes to go, and I don't want to keep you up, keep you here longer. Let's have a question here. Thanks.
Peter, I thought this was a terrific book and presentation. Thank you. Just reading from the dust cover, Bob Solow says, Peter Henry had the original thought that the experience of emerging economies may contain lessons for advanced economies. He shows that they do, but not in any crude cookie-cutter way. The vital common thread is the capacity to form a future-oriented policy and stick to it with discipline. This is why we, all of us, need grown-ups. You've been an advisor to the president and in the transition team. Do you think we have enough grown-ups? So it seems like we don't right now. What might advice you give to Obama or his administration to try to increase the ability to behave like grown-ups at least?
Yeah. It's a great question. So I think if I could, I'd like to borrow an example from the tiny island of Barbados here. So, and I won't give a long story, but basically, if you go back and look in the book, there's a story in there of how Barbados overcame economic crisis in 1992 by forming bonds between the private sector, the government, and the unions. And the key to that was communication and conversation. And finding a way in a very difficult situation to have conversations about forming some kind of a social compact. And I think the president has already begun to take important steps by having conversations. And I think it's going to be critical that we be able to focus on principles of where we want to go before we get into get mired in details, which can get us locked in the traditional sort of ideological positions. So the short answer is, you know, the book is about economic policy, but it's also about relationships, and relationships matter deeply. And so whatever we can do to build better relationships across the parties, I mean personal relationships, and I don't mean that in any inappropriate sense, but the ability to make hard decisions is critically enhanced, again, by trust. And trust comes from having better relationships. So I think the president has started to try to do that. And it's not just a week's worth of lunch. It's going to be a long road.
Let's talk about the relationship between the North and the South, as far as allowing developing and emerging economies to have a greater say. You're seeing that, you know, there is resistance. Domenico knows is, I followed very closely governance issues in the IMF.
Yep.
I mean, you look at that relation, and there's very little trust, and there is also very little trust among the developing countries and the emerging economies, you know, which is why they can't agree to stand behind one emerging economy. How do you see, you know, that trust being developed?
So very good points. I think there are two things that have to happen, as Domenico pointed out. One, you have to have better relationships between the North and the South, as you put it. But the South also, or the former third world, the emerging nations, have to think very seriously about what is it that we want, right? And so again, responsibility, the responsibility falls both ways here. It's two-way learning, two-way listening, two-way responsibility.
Is there a danger at some time, you know, when there is a crisis, that countries look inwards? And there is a concern that, you know, that the U.S. is just focused on what's going on in the U.S. And, you know, should continue to look out as well. Yuri, do you have a comment on that?
I think it's absolutely fundamental.
When you look at trade policy?
I think it's absolutely fundamental. You look at the situation in Egypt we were talking about. 20 years ago, United States would have had the capacity to do a lot more in Egypt. Mm. European Union, or if not the European Union, a concert of European powers would have had the capacity to help more. I'm not saying they would have solved the problem, but they could have done a lot more. Now we have the three, okay, include Japan. Forget Japan. Japan is in trouble. But United States, very inward looking. Deep internal problems, very, very deep internal problems, largely of its own manufacture. And Europe, the own goal of the euro, and other issues. And they're very inward looking. And this is fundamentally important because, and I think actually the putting a lot of the emphasis on the divide between developing and advanced countries is a bit misleading. Mm. Because I have often sensed in international discussions and negotiations, et cetera, that the developing countries may very well be looking for leadership, particularly, even today, particularly, I would say, from the United States, which has a lot of special things going for it. You know, I mean, United States has to be willing to, interested and willing to project its power and be less, less absorbed by its own divisions.
Even though it doesn't have the money or the might.
Well, the money is a big problem. I think the money is a problem. The money is a problem in two ways. A, because money is often needed to do stuff internationally, and it gives you a lot of weight if you don't just talk about expanding IMF resources, but you actually contribute in a very significant way, et cetera. That makes a big difference, or whatever. You talk about the Middle East crisis. But money is also important because it's the shortage of money internally that is making the United States so divided. And makes it very, very difficult to project. You know, this is not a completely new issue, right? But I think it's become more of an issue, much more of an issue because of the economic problems, because of the inequality, and to a degree because of the fact that now, you know, the challenges, the external challenges facing the United States are just not as prominent as they were during the Cold War. They're significant, but it's not in the same class of problem.
Domenico, you wanted to...
Yeah, no, this, I want you to pick up on this issue of the U.S. role in global governance. And I do think that this is critical because what we have seen, you know, really in the latest few years is that when the U.S. has decided to engage, we did see some visible improvement in global governance. Just a couple of examples. We wouldn't have the G20 as we have it today without the decision made by President Bush to convene in Washington the Washington Summit. At the time, you know, it was the first summit, so they didn't call it G20 Summit, but it was essentially the same thing. And the subsequent decision by President Obama to institutionalize that summit, and more importantly, to pull all the U.S. political capital into that. Without that, we wouldn't have the G20 essentially, you know, having sort of replaced, in many ways, the G7, not completely, but in many ways. And, you know, giving the developing economies, emerging economies, an important platform through which interact with, you know, Western leaders. One more thing. The G20 is not just the G7 plus, 12 more countries, because it's 19 countries, not 20. But it's a different approach, because really it is a forum that, includes the heads of the international financial institutions. Never in the IMF history, the IMF managing director has, you know, talked on a regular basis with the U.S. president, with the Chinese premier, and so on and so forth. And I think this is, you know, a fundamental improvement, even if we don't have, as we spoke before, a ready outcome from each G20. You were mentioning trust. You know, you have to know each other.
Yes.
And the very fact that these leaders come together at least once a year with the heads of the international organization is something that we should not underestimate. On the money issue, sorry, just 2 seconds. you know, the very idea launched by President Obama of building a big U.S.-EU trade area, you know, I think this is, again, very, very important. It doesn't mean that the U.S. has to put fresh money on the table, but this is, again, something that, of course, is going to be looked as a potentially interesting growth driver in Europe and even here in the U.S.
Well, I'm going to try and impose self-discipline here and end this right now. And thank you very much to Professor Henrion for sharing his thoughts with us. Thank you to Yuri Dadush, Domenico Lombardi, and thank you for your time. Go out and get the book. It's all in there. Thank you.